Hey, everybody, it's Robert Bruce. I am here once again with Brian Clark, and this is number 3 of 4 content marketing Q&A podcasts that we're doing over here at Entreproducer. Thanks for joining us today. Brian, how's things today?
Things are wonderful, Robert Bruce.
Wow, that's really great to hear that you're so happy. This episode of Entreproducer, first of all, is brought to you by Authority, which is Copybloggers' content marketing training and networking community that's designed to help you become a content marketing expert for less than $1 a day. Jeez, that sucked.
Man, you're smooth. We got to leave this exactly like that. Paul Harvey just... he didn't even roll over.
Hey, you don't know how tough this is. You want to give it a shot? You want to come over here and give it a shot?
I'm not the pitch man. You're Flavor Flav. I'm Chuck D.
Okay, so listen, Brian. When you started Copyblogger back in January of 2006, what kind of resources did you turn to back then, you know, for help with some of those early questions you had?
Well, that was still kind of the tail end of making it up as you go along. You're starting to see blogs at that time that were talking about blogging and marketing, but nothing like I had experienced up to that point, which was the last 7 years. So that's kind of why I started Copyblogger in the first place. Does that kind of get at what you're getting at?
Well, yeah, I'm getting at the fact that there was a big sense, you talk about this a lot, of making it up as you went along. I mean, you certainly had skills as a copywriter. You certainly generally had a general idea of what you wanted to do and how to accomplish it. But when you got down to the nitty-gritty of, you know, everything from putting a site together, for instance, to broader content marketing strategies, email marketing, all of that, there wasn't a lot around at that time. Now, that's changed. There's resources all over the web that you could spend hours and days and months and years collecting, of course. It's out there. Two questions, though. Do you have the time? And, you know, do you trust the sources for where some of that information is coming from? And that's why we put together Authority, this content marketing and training and networking community that we've got for you. And what it is the collective wisdom and experience of everything we've learned at Copyblogger in one place. So we're rapidly approaching. If you were to check out Authority right now, it's at getauthority.net. We're rapidly approaching 100 hours of audio and video training in there, already in there just waiting for you. 100,000 words of marketing training contained in over a dozen ebook. We're doing ongoing monthly seminars and master classes on topics like content marketing, email marketing, SEO, copywriting, much more. In fact, you know, even getting down, drilling all the way down to the deep stuff with Brian and Tony Clark, our COO. 2 months ago, you guys did a masterclass on the redesign of Copyblogger and basically spilled the beans on what we did and exactly why we did it, stuff like that. There's an interactive forum in there for networking purposes. All of this is a lot more than that, but it's for less than $1 a day. So whether you need expert help with the marketing of your business or you want to become a content marketing expert yourself, check out the details over at getauthority.net. Okay, Brian, I'm going to be strict today. We got a lot of questions, and we want to get through these in the next 2 podcasts. This one today, we're covering mostly business structure and revenue type questions. So there's probably going to be a couple of instances where I'm going to cut you off in the middle of whatever you're talking about. But let's move right along. Starting with Andre.
What if I just refuse to answer? Then it'll go really quickly.
Well, that's even better. Yeah. No, that's better. I'll just let dead air for a minute or two, and I'll assume you've got nothing to say on the subject.
Cool.
Andre Palmer asks, wants to know about product development and the type of products that can be created to build a business online. So how did you approach product development generally, and then how did that lead to the actual products that we sell today?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the short answer is, you know, any product or service that can be created can be sold online and is right now. So that, you know, there really is no limitation to that. But as we've discussed here quite a bit, you know, building an audience first and really focusing in on what they need from a problem or desire standpoint narrows the universe of everything down to a very, you know, select group of people, not really a broader market, but an audience that's actually interacting with you, and then figuring out what they would need. You know, the dangerous part, you know, we talk about is assuming that you are the same as your audience. On one hand, if you're a member of the tribe you're trying to lead, then you have the same desires and problems that they do. And that has certainly helped in the course of running CopyBlogger. And whenever I would say, damn it, I want this, well, that's product development right there, because I am our target market to a certain degree. I'm slightly technical, but not really. And I'm really just focused on, you know, creating content and dealing with business issues like most business people are. So that, to our extent, was a lot of listening, a lot of observation about what was happening in the space around us, and also, you know, the things that we picked up from the audience day in and day out serving them. So that's the answer. Everyone wants something more specific than that, but it really depends. I can't tell you what to go build or what to create. Only you can discover that by finding out what your audience really needs. And again, if your problems and desires are kind of congruent with that of your audience, then you have a better feel, I think, for what's a viable product or service, as opposed to being an outsider, if you will. Not to say that it can't happen. At that point, you just have to double down on your research and your listening and really make sure that you understand what people want.
Jeff Goins invokes Michael Gerber's famous E-Myth books, the idea of building systems into businesses so that you're not running around crazy, running and doing everything yourself. And he asks, how do you work yourself out of your business, or at least the parts you don't enjoy? And he asks you specifically, Brian, do you apply some of these concepts to building a business that scales? Are there particular ideas that go along with this for online in particular? And then also the nature of online, a lot of it is human connection, you know, more of a connection with readers than many businesses have had in the past. How do you do it without undermining that connection?
Well, you know, my previous businesses, when I was doing the real estate brokerages, I definitely suffered from working too inside the business. I was bringing in all the business as a marketer, but also having to steer the entire ship. And that was why, ultimately, I was pretty unhappy at the end of that period of time. When we started building CopyBlogger, I had a mindset that I would never get into that situation again. But so even though we have evolved into a 30-person company, it was done with a very deliberate approach, to where I got to focus on what I'm good at and other people did what they're good at. And Tony Clark, our COO, was very instrumental in that. He's always been a process systems type guy. So I have to give him a lot of the credit. But the thing I had to do, and it took longer than you might think, is to let go, you know. And I think that's the case for anyone who starts a business, especially if you're doing a lot of everything at the beginning, is trusting others, finding the right people to do what needs to be done, and letting go of it and letting them do it. That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, Tom Malcolm touches on this again in the next question. He asks, basically, how do you hire and find great people? Not only great people, but that good fit in order to be able to let go.
Yeah, so it's interesting. After almost 8 years, and we have hired, you know, quite a few people at this point, but we've never run a help wanted anything. Never did a post that said we need this position filled. Never did a tweet. Never did a Craigslist ad. Never did anything like that. Everyone, every partner, and every employee, including you, Robert, came from the audience, and that's how you know. You know, I mean, we've been fortunate to this point that there's not really anyone in the company who's not a true believer, who understood what I was trying to communicate in the early days, and then as we've evolved, what we collectively have been trying to accomplish. And in fact, there's been a couple times where we considered hiring, and there were a couple people who said, no, they're just doing it, you know, because it looks good on their resume. And I think as we grow, it's going to be harder and harder – to avoid that situation, but we listened to that advice from our employees when they kind of said, they're not a bad person, they're just not one of us. And so that's the great thing about building an audience with content, because you will have people who get what you're doing, who are, I don't know, compatible with your message, with your personality, with the way you work. And that's how Copy Blogger Media grew, from the audience itself. Grow the audience, and then, you know, who wants to come and play in the other sandbox and help us grow the audience and the business?
Yeah, it's funny. I know you're not saying this, but to be clear, it's an interesting thing, because you don't want, you know, a robot type walking in, parroting everything that's coming down from above. You want the voice that you are attracted to, you know, that you found out there. You want unique.
I'm definitely not saying that, Robert.
I know you're not, but
you contrarian bastard, you. Every day I have to
look
with him.
I got to fight every single day to have my voice heard.
Every one of these people has no problem standing up to me, which actually is part of the job requirement. Like, if you're a yes man or a yes woman, I'm not going to respect you, and that doesn't work out well. So, yeah, it's true. And everyone needs to be very careful about letting their ego get involved in hiring decisions, because if you don't have someone who's going to basically elevate your game by challenging you and taking things further, then why bother?
Second part of Tom's question is interesting to me. He says the business he is working on, he plans to sell in 10 to 15 years. He makes the comment, says, I know 10 to 15 years in internet time is an eternity, but are there some basic business strategic fundamentals for setting up that possibility over the long term?
You know, create a great company. I mean, there's not, you know, that's such a long time period that's really all you can say. I read an interesting article, I think yesterday, about how companies that were acquired, especially internet companies, made sure they did everything they could other than hiring great people, building great stuff, all the things that are just the standard for what you have to do in this very transparent age we live in. They made sure that they had messaging around culture and what they believed in as an organization, how they treated their employees, what their philosophy and policies that related to that all were. Because it turns out, according to the article, that a lot of companies that are acquired for outrageous sums, it's done because the cultural fit with the acquiring company is so tight that it becomes like a no-brainer. They know it's not just a strategic acquisition of technology or people. It's that plus the fact that they're going to come in and mesh immediately. So I thought that was pretty good advice, and I took that article to heart. The hardest thing, you know, for us as a company and the way we work, you know, we work virtually from all over North America. We even have someone now in Brazil. So we're expanding beyond North America. And we operate just fine using, you know, internet technology. We also have a very kind of, I don't know what the right word for it is with our culture, but, you know, no one's hovering over you virtually or otherwise. You get your work done, you know, you contribute, and that's all we ask of you. So we have a cool culture, which is why people love to work for us. It's just weird for me, because when we do talk to other companies or people that are looking to invest or whatever, and we keep saying no to everyone, is that they almost don't understand how our culture works, even though I think this form of company is becoming more and more prevalent. So for us, it's interesting to me, like, who would be a company that would actually acquire us that was okay with the way we are, but also matched up with that? So for me, I don't really think about it much, because we've got way more to do before I worry about that. But I did think that was an interesting thing to focus on that you don't hear every day. You know, make a great product, make a great service, hire great people. The culture of your company has to be defined and talked about, and then you'll hopefully find someone who has the same values, and then that makes the acquisition of your company more of a done deal than just something to mull over.
Matt Frazier of the great site No Meat Athlete wants to play a bigger game. He says, much in the same way Copyblogger did in jumping into, eventually jumping into software, becoming a software company. And he lists some things here that he can envision selling in the future, like branded energy bars that relate, you know, directly to the to what he's talking about, protein powders and such, doing live events. But seems like an issue of capital or not having it, hiring more employees like we were just talking about, and getting set up into more mainstream distribution channels. And he says, essentially, his question is, again, without knowing the very specifics of his business now, is your opinion to keep bootstrapping or to go the other route of seeking startup capital and funding?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a right answer to this necessarily that's universal. I think I built the company the way I did through joint ventures, partnerships, because I had an aversion to dealing with money people. My ultimate goal as an entrepreneur, I've come to realize, isn't necessarily money, it's freedom. And freedom from someone meddling with you and telling you what to do is pretty high up on my chart. Not that I can't collaborate with others. I think the opposite has been proven by the route we did take. It was all collaboration. But that, to me, is dealing with someone as a partner instead of dealing with investors who, you know, they want to see a return on their money. I think, you know, I have no idea if I would have gone down the other path, how it would have turned out. I personally would rather bootstrap if I can than take someone else's money, especially just anyone's money, because there's the old story of smart money and dumb money. And even the money out there, the people out there who purport to understand what you're doing, that understand the internet, understand content marketing, whatever, they're still not doing it. They're money people. They provide funding to get a return on that funding. So to some degree, all money is going to come back and haunt you at the end of the day if things don't go exactly right. And even if they do go exactly right, you know, you still have people that are that own equity in your company. So it's a personal decision. Obviously, it's done many ways, but every single person, every entrepreneur I talk to who's taken money basically says, don't ever take money, Brian. You own your company. I wish I owned my company, but I couldn't figure out how to do it any other way. I mean, we're an example of doing it another way. It just depends on if it's right for you or not.
Joe Bunting asks, how do you market free when so many other content creators are doing the very same? And he brings up specifically authors and musicians. We talked about this in the last two episodes of this content Q&A series. And, you know, a lot of it, Joe, just comes down to flat out excellence. I mean, that's, you know, there's no question that it is an issue. It is a problem of the internet. The availability used to be the big issue was you couldn't get your movie made or it was too expensive to produce your own record. That's done. That's a done deal. Anybody can do that now, or your own book. The problem now is there's so much available and there's so much, there's only so much attention available for that. So, but, you know, Brian had talked about playing the bigger game, creating something so awesome that it just cannot be denied. I also like what Jay Baer has been saying in his book, Utility, which is the usefulness play. It's like either, so go ahead and talk a little bit about that, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, since the very beginning, I was saying you got to give away something that is otherwise worth paying for, right? It can't just be free crap. And the corollary to that was, you know, if you feel like you're giving away too much, you're on the right track. But Jay, in his book Utility, basically, you know, kind of put that concept as core to what he was talking about in that book, which is give away content that's worth paying for. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So I think for someone like us, or someone who's selling services or selling hard goods or software or whatever, something other than content, that's easy because you create content and then you charge for your service or your product or whatever. I think people who are content creators primarily struggle with this because they're like, wait, I got to sell my content. I can't give it away for free. And of course, that's, you know, a big part of what we examine in our teaching sales program about, you know, the type of stuff you give away versus the type of stuff that you charge for. And a lot of times it comes down to access and organization and premium formats such as video and audio and transcripts and worksheets and all that kind of stuff that we do in Authority, because people do put a premium on the total package as opposed to the bits and pieces that come out, especially with blog posts or perhaps a free report that covers, you know, one aspect of an issue. So that's really what it comes down to. What you give away and what you charge for have to both kick ass.
Yeah, I like, I don't know if it was Jay himself or someone on his behalf, but made the analogy of, I think what Steve Jobs' line was, Apple, you know, makes insanely great products. And you could transfer that to a marketing message of, you've got to make something insanely great. And what Jay is essentially saying is, well, the alternative to that is to make something insanely useful. Whether or not you think you can make something insanely great, you know, that's up to you. That requires skill, dedication, time, persistence, all of that. That's up to you. But I think it's pretty clear that just about anybody can be insanely useful. Louise Fletcher, very interesting question here. So she runs a resume writing and job search business. And the nature of that business is one where the audience, of course, is naturally short term. Come in, pay for the service, gone. She has an audience where she has a people's attention only while they're looking for a job. So how does that work when you're talking about a content strategy online to attract that audience, a naturally short-term audience?
There's lots of businesses that are naturally short-term. I was in real estate. There's a window, a period of time that people will look for a house depending whether they're local or relocating. So that's your sales cycle. And then once they start looking, usually depending on the market, you know, you've got something under contract and then, you know, in 3 weeks or so, and then a month later, it's closed and it's over, right? And yet all those done customers are your biggest source of word of mouth referrals. So in that regard, your sales cycle may be short, but your communication with the people that have actually become customers and clients, you don't want to stop communicating with them. And I think, I'm not sure if we talked about this type of business in a past Q&A, but the ability to expand your suite of products and services to these people once you have helped them out with a resume, such as, you know, general career advice about rising within the organization. I think the most telling point is no job is expected to last 20 years anymore. So is it really a one-time and gone thing? I don't think so. So just start thinking long-term. What more can I do to help this person? And how can I stay in touch with them in order to get referrals, but also to help them out next time they need to change jobs?
Esther Litchfield Fink says she loves writing, and she hates doing everything else related to her business. I'm sort of paraphrasing Esther here, but all the technical stuff, setting up the site, maintaining the site, writing copy, adding, you know, for opt-in pages, all of that. Selling, she doesn't like selling. She says, until I can afford to hire help with some of that other stuff, how do I do it all?
I don't know what kind of business she has, if it's a service business or whatnot, but creating the content itself is probably the most important thing at first, because that's going to bring you enough new business. Even if you're really bad at copy and, you know, closing the deal kind of stuff, you know, generally you'll do better. Back when I was kind of starving because I was trying to figure out how to make money from online advertising in the late 90s, you know, that's when I started real quick a legal newsletter on internet issues. And it just took off. I don't even think I had a call to action, you know? I mean, it was just a demonstration of my knowledge. You know, I was a younger attorney, and yet I understood the internet in ways that the older guys didn't understand at all. So all of a sudden I was getting, you know, people wanting to hire me, all this kind of good stuff. As far as the site stuff, you know, I feel your pain on that. You know, we've been working since 2008 to make WordPress more user-friendly. A lot of people, you know, WordPress is the most popular CMS on the internet. You know, 17% of all sites use it. It's some massive amount. But if you really look at it from the perspective of a newbie, it's not that easy. So we're right in the middle of working on projects to where we make it easy for people like this to just go create the content, develop a little bit more business, and then get some help from a copywriter to write some landing pages, some calls to action, stuff like that. We as a company are headed in the direction to where, you know, we've got our traditional DIY kind of products set. You know, we have the components of a complete online marketing system because we built it for ourselves, but we sell it piece by piece. I think where we're headed is providing this turnkey complete solution that's not only powerful, but it's just easy to set up and it's there. And then you just create content and you go. So, you know, we're working on that problem. I understand that the tech side is. At this point, I would just get someone to get you set up on WordPress. Use, you know, a stock theme or something simple. Don't spend a lot of money yet. And then just get in there and write and post. That's the easy part. And then once you start seeing some revenue from that, you definitely have to take it to the next level and, you know, get some help if you really hate doing all the other stuff.
Yeah, there are some great options, Brian. You just tweeted last week, I think. Young guy, can't think of his name right now, but it's genesistweaks.com. Things like that. There's people out there for relatively affordable, you know, prices that can help you with some of that stuff you may want to get into. But Brian's right. The main thing is get the thing up and start creating content. Because once that's in there, that can be transformed design-wise into anything later on. Ed Feng asks, what do you think about ClickBank?
A few years ago, ClickBank was really big in the info product, ebook kind of, you know, space, a lot of red headlines, a lot of yellow highlighters. But it was just like a turnkey digital delivery system that also had their payment processing and affiliate program tied in, I think. So it was really big in the IM crowd. I've lost track of it, kind of how I lost track of those people because they seem to have all disappeared. I'm sure they're out there somewhere. But I have not kept up with what ClickBank is doing. Our premise software does a lot of what ClickBank does, except it's not, you know, a hosted solution. So if you need that type of functionality, you don't necessarily have to go with a ClickBank or an eJunkie or something like that in order to get it.
So Jennifer Blanchard put together an opt-in and page for, created an interest list for a product that she was developing that was about to be released. And relatively quickly got a great response. A lot of people signed up for this list to be notified when her product was available. So the product comes out, and as she puts it, she got crickets, nothing. She's asking, what did I do wrong? So this is a big question. There's all kinds of possibilities here, Jennifer. We can go over a few of those. She brings up the price. Maybe the price was wrong. Maybe something, you know, wrong with copy on the sales page. But generally, she's asking, with a good response in that interest list, a lot of opt-ins, she figured it was pretty hard evidence, as she puts it, that it was a product worth creating. What are some of the things, again, without seeing the sales page, without all of that, Brian, that we can have Jennifer take a look at and pay attention to?
Well, in that situation, I guess, first thing I would have done is email that list again and ask. And then just listen and see what people say, because they know why they weren't interested. The flip side of that is that a lot of people will tell you they'll buy something, but until they buy it, you can't really trust that. But I would take their feedback after not buying more seriously than I would take someone who says, yes, I'd buy that. And a lot of marketers make that mistake. They ask people what they want, and then they get responses, and they make that, and then no one buys it. Well, it's like Steve Jobs said, it's your job to figure out what they need to buy, not theirs. They don't know what they want to buy. They know they have a problem. They know they have a desire. So Jennifer, without knowing what problem or desire your product was trying to fix and how you arrived at that, I don't know. The other point I'll bring up is that 85 people isn't very many. And again, I don't know the price point. I don't know anything. I have seen people build small lists with high-priced products, and they made a fortune off of, you know, 10 sales. But in the grand scheme of things, 85 people may not have been a big enough list to actually indicate the kind of interest that you needed.
So John Corcoran asks a dangerous question for us, Brian. He's talking about launching a book and launching it specifically as a platform. He wants to use it as a platform for down the road webinars, further training, courses, things like that. It's a business book, but building a business off of this, starting with the book. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, that's, I mean, he understands at least that you don't make money from the book. You make money from what you do after the book. Eric Ries with the Lean Startup basically did exactly that, you know. But the Lean Startup was a blog well before it was a book, and that's what told Eric, you know, and that's what got Eric speaking gigs. And then Eric knew he was onto something, so he wrote the book, and it did become the platform. Now he does the conferences and all that. Outside of that situation, and Robert, you and I, you know, how many times do we go over the book or not?
We're getting there. We're getting there,
everybody. That is the question. If you understand that the money comes from the platform and not book sales, do you really need the book? You know, I always say books have terrible SEO. You know, books can't be shared in social media. What if you wrote the book sequentially on a blog and thought about, you know, chunks of content that were sociably shareable, that were going to attract the right type of person to you, get them on an email list, and then you start your first conference or whatever, and it's a small show, just like Chris Guillebeau did that, you know. He'd been building his platform up. He did write books, but he also has, you know, freely available content. And really the here's the thing, to sell a book, you need a platform first. I guess that's what I'm really trying to say.
Right.
You know, anyone out there will tell you that right now. So I don't think you can write a book and make it a platform. Again, even Eric Ries, who wrote this massive bestseller, he started out blogging first. There, without an audience, you don't know, you know, how do you get that audience, you know? It happens from time to time. I'm reading this great series of fiction, actually. Oh, and I've totally forgotten the author's name, but it's kind of like the science fiction. This guy basically started writing short ebooks that were essentially parts of the story he wanted to tell. And the response to each part was so great that people wanted them bundled together, which he did. And then they wanted the prequel, which he wrote. And then they wanted the after story, which I haven't got to yet, but it's
Hugh
coming
Howie.
Out. Yeah, it's Hugh Howey. You knew what I was talking about.
Great story.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's a great writer. And this is his, you know, he was a children's author, I think, but this was his first adult fiction. And I've just been enthralled with it. But the story's kind of cool, too, because he did do the Amazon dream thing. It happens. But look at it statistically, right? How many people does it happen to compared to those who all these people who got book deals because they had the audience first? You know, that's what Seth Godin's Domino Project is predicated on. Audience first. Okay, now we'll do a book. And we don't need traditional distribution. We'll just do a deal with Amazon and we'll put it out there. So we're platform first people. If you want advice other than that, I can't give it to you because that's my experience.
It is interesting to me. Even as these years go by and as the web becomes more and more robust and simple and powerful, it's like, it's interesting to me that we're still, I mean, of course, we're still hanging on to the book, the idea of the book. But like you said, all of the benefits of the open web, yes, we're going to get to this more specifically, but I got to say it again, what you said, it's you need the platform to sell that thing anyway. And what is the platform? What is the ultimate platform? It's your own website, you know, in one form or another. All right, let's move on. Otherwise, this is going to turn into like 2.5 hours. Clarabella asks, what is the best business model for a freelance writer?
Ah, that's an easy one. So before the mainstreaming of content marketing, the freelance writer was in a tough boat. Either you were just a total badass direct response copywriter who could command high fees and get royalties on sales and all that kind of stuff, you know, or you managed to get some good regular clients that needed you time and time again, as opposed to the hunter-gatherer model of freelance writing, which is all too common. But now that we have content marketing, I love Joe Paluzzi of Content Marketing Institute did an article a couple weeks ago, maybe it was, is this content marketing or clever advertising? You know, and he went through these different examples, and a lot of what turned out that some people were calling content marketing was really just an advertising campaign with the emphasis on campaign. It ended, right? It stopped. Content marketing does not. So if you hook up with some businesses that get it, that understand that this is an ongoing media production role that they're involved in, then you have good clients because they have to pay you every month and you have a steady stream of work. And once you have a portfolio of 5 good clients, you're making 100-something grand a year, and it's up to you. Do you want to go above that? Do you want to expand? Do you want to turn into an agency, or do you just want to have a good life? That's the best gig for a freelance writer. It's creating the content month in, month out that needs to be done. And of course, that includes copy. You can negotiate pretty good monthly retainer agreements, $2,000 to $3,000, maybe more. You know, I think the key here is don't be afraid to explain what's necessary, and don't be afraid to charge what you're worth.
Army asks, how do you go about setting and prioritizing business goals in terms of traffic, social sharing, sales, building email lists, and developing features for products?
Well,
I hope
this doesn't sound flippant, but most of those aren't business goals. Those are means to achieving business goals. Sales are your business goals, right? I mean, you could even argue that product development is on the path to your ultimate objectives, but I won't go quite that far because it's so the means by which product development happens are so closely intertwined with the ultimate objectives, you know. So,
yeah, and a goal like traffic, even setting specific traffic goals with specific numbers is essentially not a goal. What you do to try to get to that point would be the actual goal. So in terms of, you know, making contact.
Traffic is not an objective because even if you have an advertising model, you know, unless you sell advertising at prices that will sustain you, the traffic itself is still not really turning into money. It's a necessary step in the process, but I think so many people get hung up on traffic for traffic's sake and aren't really thinking about, okay, how do I get the kind of traffic that turns into, you know, whatever step is next, whether that's an email subscription or a purchase. That's the ultimate goal. That's the objective of a business. There's no business that exists to get web traffic, even with an advertising model, because their objective is to sell advertising.
All right, I'm going to monkey with Lenny Ramirez's question here just a little bit. Let's say, Brian, there's a perfect world in which you knew our products, Scribe and Genesis, needed to be created, right? You just had some magic ball that told you, yes, these are two products that are definitely, there is a demand for them. Mm-hmm. However, all you had was the idea, what you wanted it to do. How would you go about putting together the development team to create those products, also knowing what you know now?
I would kind of be speculating because that's not the way we did it, you know. I, you know, in 2005, when I was starting Copyblogger, I was a big fan of 37 Signals, and I was jealous because I was like, too bad I can't do software. I'd really like to do that. You know, and then when you think about it, though, they were a design firm. They couldn't do software either, but they came across the right people, and Jason knew what he wanted to build, and they made it happen. I do know that, you know, the world of software development is a tough one. It's tough to get the right people. It's tough to stay on time schedule. It's tough to stay under budget, all of those good things. So it's really hard for me to answer this question because I specifically took actions that could get this stuff done without me having to do something I felt unqualified to do.
But as far as
understanding what people want and being, I'm heavily involved in product development, but, you know, kind of like Jobs was. He wasn't a coder. He just knew, he understood people, right? So that's the role that I have to play. So I guess I would, you know, assemble the team based on skill set and still do the same thing. I just know that I'd probably would have had a worse experience doing it that way.
Steve Price, on our discussions of native advertising, affiliate marketing, advertorials, and all of that, he is asking specifically, what are the legal requirements and aspects? Closes by asking about yourboulder.com in particular, noticing that you don't declare anything there as of yet.
I don't declare anything there because I don't do anything there.
Right. Nothing's happening yet.
No ads, native or otherwise. It's all content.
Right.
We haven't gotten to that part of the model yet, mainly because I don't have a huge amount of time. And also because of the real estate component of that, we haven't got a license yet. So anyway, I'm not worried about it. The Boulder site is a long-term play for sure. But okay, so legally, paid advertisements need to be labeled as advertising so as not to be deceptive. That's also just good editorial practice to make sure you're not betraying the trust of your audience. And then there's the non-law law, that being the law of Google. You know, you've recently had Matt Cutts come out and say, you know, if you're going to do advertorial style content, you need to nofollow the links in order to avoid getting slapped by Google. Now, a lot of people confuse the law with Google. They're not necessarily congruent. In this case, you know, labeling it as an advertisement or a sponsored post is a requirement both of the law, of a good ethical publisher, and of Google. But Google takes it a step further and says you've got to, you know, add a tag to the link so that Google doesn't recognize it as, you know, affecting rankings. So that's generally what you have to do with native advertising. It's not that complicated. You only get into trouble when you're trying to hide the fact that it is actually sponsored or paid for content.
Chris M. asks, what's the process of seeking out venture capital for startup ideas? What does that look like? And or how do you build something viable so that venture capitalists might start sniffing around?
Never done either. I will tell you that the VC world is falling out of favor with just about everyone because it's not necessary. But, you know, if the first thing you're thinking of is I got to raise money, I would ask you why. You know, why not just get started? And if you can get started and succeed, you may not want them sniffing around. They've been sniffing around us for a long time, and you've noticed we still haven't taken money.
Katie Hendrickson, is a freelance marketing copywriter. Works a lot with big companies, wants to work with smaller companies as well. But there's some inherent issues with working with smaller companies, including budgets. You're more involved in some cases in smaller places with, you know, certain personalities. This is the my business is my baby. And, you know, you have to kind of work with the person on that. But she'd love to find a way to be able to work with small businesses, you know, she says, at rates they can afford, but she hasn't been able to find a model to do that. Any ideas on this?
Yeah, it's a tough question. It's really hard to provide marketing services to small companies for those reasons that she outlined. And usually the bigger companies are much easier to work with, much easier to get paid, all that. John Jantz of Duct Tape Marketing and I have talked about this a lot because he had the same desire. He wanted to work with the small business people. That was his passion. But he ran into the same issue you did. They don't have the money. They don't have the time, blah, blah, blah. But that's a huge market. And essentially what it comes down to is one way that John dealt with it was through, you know, productizing service, essentially creating a bunch of training materials and then having a network of coaches that can assist with the small business people, you know, after they're in the program and it works on a more scalable way. Now, that sounds like a huge thing to grow, but of course, John was just like you one day and he just started working. Our teaching sales program has this exact business model on how you create training programs and community, very much like what we did with Authority. I mean, we have no desire to do individual consulting for one thing, but you're right, it wouldn't work. But for, you know, less than, I don't know what it is, $350 a year, $29 a month, you know, any small business can afford that. And they can learn what they need to learn. They can meet the people they need to meet if they want to hire freelancers, if they want to get a partner, go, you know, all that kind of stuff. So in essence, Authority is one example of solving the problem. John Jantz's approach is another way of solving the problem. It's really a growth area, though, providing this marketing services in the form of training, community, and access to you. But access to you through a forum or other structured mechanism like calls or something else to where you don't lose your mind, you're making good living, and they're getting what they need from you.
We've got three questions here at the end. We're going to move into the tools and tech section, which is what I've dubbed this group of questions. So one question from Stephen. So he's asking an in-depth review, the pros and cons of all content marketing platforms. He lists out a few. He says he's a Copyblogger fan, owns all the products and services, but recently bumped over to another provider that was a more all-in-one solution, but still open. WordPress seems like a do-it-yourself solution where I'd work with many different solutions to do everything. I'm on board with content marketing, but need to more understand the pros and cons to each of these solutions.
Yeah, okay. So you're thinking about HubSpot, which is expensive and proprietary. You're on WordPress now and you own all our stuff. Well, if you own everything that we use, and I don't know, I think we're pretty good at content marketing. Robert, are we okay?
Yeah, I think we're okay. I was going to say, too, we're going to be partial in answers to these tools and tech questions, but I think that's pretty obvious.
I can't help it. We built this stuff for ourselves. It's not a, you know, it's not a pitch or whatever. That's the truth. So anyway, that if you have everything, you actually have a complete system. The only thing we don't have is analytics. We use Google Analytics, and we've got some really neat things that we can do with that. In fact, Jessica and Tony are talking more and more about data using Google Analytics and some of the tricks that we use to integrate that with email and with social and all sorts of other things. But so, I mean, I guess that's my answer. And I, you know, certainly have nothing against HubSpot, but it is proprietary. And I would never go and pay $500 a month for a proprietary system because that makes me nervous. You know, I like having, now open source obviously isn't perfect, and you are correct. WordPress has been the ultimate DIY, you know, it's free and there's this huge community and you've got all these people who develop plugins and whatnot. And then the premium marketplace sprung out of that because people do need support. People do need things that WordPress doesn't do. I mean, for us, Premise is a huge part of that. I mean, literally our whole site is built with, you know, WordPress, Genesis, and Premise. And then it's hosted with our hosting, and then we use Scribe internally. So that is the whole thing. But it's built on something that is constantly evolving and becoming better due to a community and not a corporation. Sometimes that doesn't matter. Sometimes it does. That's just the way I am. So we are moving towards a WordPress-based complete system that becomes more turnkey, where you don't even have to mess with all the stuff that you have to do when you're setting up WordPress. And this will be coming next year, and we're really excited about it. But from a DIY standpoint, you could put it together yourself. I just understand what a pain that can be sometimes, which is why I'm so passionate about getting around that for people like you. And for, we had an earlier question said the same thing. No one wants to mess with that tech stuff. I don't want to mess with that tech stuff.
And Austin White follows up with a very similar question, but he's asking basically a quick explanation of the tools that we use in general day to day to actually run this business.
So everything that we make, we use, what is the name of the editorial calendar plugin, Robert?
It's WP Calendar. Of course,
WP Calendar. We tried out some other stuff, but we came back to that, didn't we?
Yeah. Well, we started on, obviously, on Genesis from StudioPress, the Genesis framework for WordPress. But then, yeah, on top of that, we've got WP Calendar. You want to get into plugins and everything, huh?
Well, I mean, again, the main things that we use are Genesis, Premise, Scribe. I mean, Scribe does everything that you need to research, create, optimize, promote content, right? And that's really what content marketing is. That is what is encompassed. Genesis helps you do, you know, SEO and other tasks without getting into code. And Premise is the really powerful software that allows you to build, you know, the My Copy Blogger backend. That's also seamlessly integrated with Authority, which is a paid portion, not a free portion. All of that, some people still don't believe that that was all built with Premise off the shelf, but it was. And it was Rafal, a designer, and Chris Garrett, a blogger, who built it, not our developers. Well, they built Premise, but they didn't build My Copy Blogger. I should clarify there. They were actually, non-coders were able to put that together. Now, Garrett and Rafal both know a little bit of code, but you get my point.
Tom Malcolm shows up again. He's doing video and he asks, to YouTube or not to YouTube? Why or why not?
This now is that's an excellent question. I would encourage you to go read Jason Calacanis' latest post over on Launch about, you know, building in someone else's ecosystem. He was one of the big dog YouTube channel players, and he quit and did not renew his contract, said no to AOL's money. No, not AOL, Google's money. But he got bought by AOL.
Flashback 7 years.
Right, yeah, I know. Anyway, he did take AOL's money. So that's a good point about why you don't want to depend on something like YouTube. Now, can you use it as a supplementary marketing channel? Of course. From what I understand, YouTube's the second biggest search engine in the world behind Google's main search engine, because those, when people are looking for video content based on certain keywords, you know, that is your opportunity to show up. But just remember, your site that you own on your domain is your home base. Everything points into it from the outside, and that would include YouTube. Now, I'm not that up to speed on what you can do with YouTube these days as far as embedding, you know, links, and because I, basically in the tech section of YouTube videos, it doesn't seem like you can make an active link, but I think you can do things at the end of the video or embedded within the video itself. Just figure out a way. If you can get found on YouTube and drive traffic back to your site, then yes. If you can't figure that out, don't.
Yeah, video is tricky too, in that it is extremely, or can get extremely expensive to host on your own. So an option like YouTube is, I mean, in some cases, unless it's part of your business plan, of course, it can be the only way to go. We use Vimeo Pro for all of our kind of mission critical, you know, like webinars paid stuff we do. And a lot of that has to do, I mean, you can make videos private on YouTube, of course, but it's going back to the idea that we're paying for a service. And when you're paying for something, you know, you're helping along
a
business.
You're a customer. You're not the product.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Godin's post today, I think, was it today or yesterday, that basically, again, driving it home once again, if you're getting it for free, you're the product, not the customer. And it's interesting with Vimeo, because, you know, the video on our homepage, that's the most highly trafficked page on CopyBlogger, and I'm sure it gets played a few times a day. But I don't think the expense is outrageous or anything. I don't know.
Yeah, they've brought that to a really reasonable monthly cost. Maybe we can bring Tony on here and talk about some of this stuff later. But yeah, as opposed to if we were hosting that ourselves, you know, you're getting into crazy territory. So, or you can, depending on the traffic, of course. But it's real reasonable and reliable. All right. We're going to close this podcast with an incredibly difficult question from Jesse Werner. Jesse, thanks for this, by the way, because this is one of my favorite questions. This is, how exactly do you make your websites mobile-friendly, responsive, otherwise known as, and available for mobile visitors? Do you use certain plugins or any optimization?
Yeah, that is a good question. So before the last couple years, the popular approach was to create a mobile version of the site, and with WordPress, there was a plugin for that. I forget what it's called, but it generated what, in my opinion, a fairly ugly, generic, non-branded version of your site, but that's better than nothing at all. But now we have what's called responsive design, or as we call it, mobile responsive, because that's a little more descriptive of what you really want it for. It's responsive because it adapts to any screen. That means desktop, 27-inch monitor, laptop, you know, Mac Air, tablet, iPhone, Android, whatever. The design adapts automatically by detecting what type of device and screen is viewing it. So in essence, there's no plugins or anything. The design itself is created to work that way. So we just released Genesis 2.0. It's inherently mobile responsive now. Every new theme that we put out, you know, including all the HTML5 and all the future of the web type stuff, at a right net here, right now, what you need, especially every local website, every website in general. Robert, have you noticed how some of the biggest media sites out there are not responsive at all? And I'm just like, you know, my little website is, you know, perfectly responsive, and CBS or whatever can't get it done. But anyway, basically now for about $100, you could buy a mobile responsive theme if you wanted to get it done custom. It's a lot cheaper than it was just a year and a half ago because of the advances in frameworks and whatnot. And I'm talking about WordPress here, but mobile responsive as a concept works. It's at the HTML level and the CSS level, so it works on any website. It just depends on, you know, what price tag you're going to get put on it. I know there are some designers out there that are still charging people who don't know better $5,000 to make their site responsive. But think about it, for a local restaurant and your site is basically unreadable on a phone, that's bad for business. So they're paying the money. But I'm just here to tell you that you can get it done, especially if you use WordPress, for very cheaply.
That's it. Thank you for listening. We've got one more of these content marketing Q&A podcasts, and it's going to be covering hyperlocal questions, your questions on hyperlocal websites and strategy and such. Brian, you're on the road here for a little while, so we'll try to get that done as soon as possible. But thanks for listening, everybody. Remember, if you like this podcast, head over to getauthority.net. Check out what we've got for you there. And we'll see you next time. Brian, drive safe.
You too, sir.